the leader of Hamas is on the move. Is there an agreement in the works?
Hamas says Haniyeh would discuss the war with Egyptian officials after having arrived in Cairo.
Plus, the Colorado State Supreme Court has decided that Donald Trump is not eligible to run for re-election.
If you are somebody who has sworn an oath to support the Constitution and then engaged in insurrection, you're not qualified to hold federal or state office.
And later, a look at the borders between Russia and Finland, Poland and Ukraine, and Israel and Lebanon. Today is Wednesday, December 20th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Coming up first today, another developing story from the Middle East. Hamas says its top leader, Ismail Haniyeh, has arrived in Cairo for talks on the war in Gaza and the possibility of another release of hostages in exchange for prisoners. The AP's Charles de la Desma reports.
Egypt, along with Qatar, where Haniyeh is believed to be based, have both played a key role as mediators between the militant group and Israel since the war that began with Hamas's October 7 incursion into Israel. Hamas says Haniyeh would discuss the war with Egyptian officials after having arrived in Cairo, but did not provide details. Negotiations are underway on another ceasefire and the release of more hostages held by the militant group, but the two sides are believed to be far from an agreement. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And yet another developing story today, this time from the American West, where the Colorado State Supreme Court has decided that former President Donald Trump is not eligible to run for president because of his actions leading to and during the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol building. The lawsuit was brought by CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. I spoke with the president and CEO of CREW, Noah Bookbinder.
So this lawsuit was brought on behalf of six Republican and unaffiliated voters in Colorado, asserting that Donald Trump is disqualified from serving as president and should be removed from the ballot under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which has a clause that says that if you are somebody who has sworn an oath to support the Constitution and then engaged in insurrection, you're not qualified to hold federal or state office. And our plaintiffs took the position, and ultimately the Colorado Supreme Court agreed, that that's essentially what had happened here, that Donald Trump, in inciting a violent mob to attack the Capitol to try to halt the peaceful transfer of power, had engaged in insurrection against the Constitution and was therefore disqualified.
Donald Trump and a lot of his supporters are saying this is just a political witch hunt. This is Joe Biden out to get Donald Trump before the election. But you said the plaintiffs in this case were Republicans and unaffiliated voters, not Democrats, not leftists. Who were they?
So these were six voters in Colorado, all people who are eligible to vote in the Republican primary. So they're all either Republicans or independents. They include Norma Anderson, who is the former Republican majority leader of the Colorado State Senate and Colorado State House at different times. It includes Krista Kafer, who is a very conservative columnist for the Denver Post, an active Republican. It includes Claudine Schneider, who was a Republican member of the U.S. House of Representatives. So these are not a bunch of Democrats, a bunch of liberals. They're not certainly not Washington liberals. These are people in Colorado who are deeply committed to the Constitution, very concerned about a candidate who is unqualified and a candidate who has threatened democracy appearing on the ballot. And the legal team also included top Republican and Democratic Colorado lawyers, as well as lawyers from our nonpartisan nonprofit.
Now, what happens next? Trump has said this will get appealed to the Supreme Court. Can they overrule the Colorado decision and get Trump back on the ballot in Colorado? Can they rule for the whole country and keep Trump off the ballot everywhere? How does the system work?
So what the Colorado Supreme Court said is they made this decision that Donald Trump needs to be removed from the ballot, which was really a historic decision. They also recognized the kind of stakes here, and they said that they were going to stay their decision. So it's not going to go into effect until January 4th, which is the day before ballots need to be printed in Colorado, giving Donald Trump time to appeal the decision. His representatives have said that he will appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Obviously, we don't know that for sure unless and until it happens. But assuming that appeal does happen, we expect the U.S. Supreme Court would be likely to take it up. They're not required to. They would be likely to move quickly. And at that point, the U.S. Supreme Court can affirm the decision and say that it goes forward. They can reverse it. Whether they affirm it or reverse it, that ruling is going to have effect over the entire United States. It's not necessarily going to, for instance, if they were to affirm the Colorado Supreme Court's ruling, it wouldn't necessarily mean that Donald Trump would be automatically off of the ballot everywhere. There are still procedures in every state. But whatever the U.S. Supreme Court says would dictate what the law is in those procedures state by state. And so it would be enormously influential.
Noah Bookbinder is president and CEO of CREW, that's Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. His group led the charge and represented the plaintiffs in the recent Colorado lawsuit barring Donald Trump from running for president there, keeping him off the ballot. Noah, thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much.
And now to the Middle East. Despite the U.S. Defense Secretary's announcement of a new multinational operation to safeguard commerce in the Red Sea, this in response to a series of missile and drone attacks on vessels in vital shipping lanes, the Iran-backed Houthi militant group says it will not be deterred. VOA's Lori London spoke with Brian Carter, the Salafi jihadism team lead at American Enterprises Critical Threats Project, who says this isn't just about revenge in Gaza, but rather Iran's evolving strategy and broader plans in the region.
As we look at this conflict, it's important to take into account the broader regional context at play and to kind of think through this from how Iran views the region, how Iran sets up its objectives for the region. So one of their key objectives is forcing out U.S. troops in the region, in addition to other items such as becoming more of a regional hegemon and, of course, the destruction of the state of Israel. So what we've seen over the last 2 months is, at first, Iran is attempting to deter an Israeli ground operation to the Gaza Strip. They're attempting to see if they can save their partner in Hamas. Now their objectives are shifting. And it's important to take into context that the region to understand these objective shifts. So if you look at the Bab al-Mandeb, where the Houthis are, of course, conducting these attacks against commercial shipping, Iran has for years attempted to demonstrate that it could, in its words, close the Straits of Hormuz in a conflict with the United States or U.S. allies. And now what it is demonstrating is, in fact, that it can shut down two major trade routes in the region, which has implications for, of course, global trade, but also U.S. partners, U.S. allies in the Gulf region.
So basically, Iran has its hands in a number of places to try to destroy the United States and Israel. And when you say Iran, you're referring as far as the Red Sea, you're also referring to the Houthis and Iran as kind of one and the same?
Yeah, I'm referring to, yes, thanks for the clarification there. I think when I refer to Iran, I'm referring to Iran and its network of proxies and partners. And Iran views these proxies and partners as its coalition with which it can begin to undertake operations to accomplish its objectives. So, you know, one of the important things for Iran is of course, forcing U.S. forces out of the region, not necessarily destroying the United States, but getting the United States out of the region and doing stuff like attempting to force the United States out of Iraq along political and military lines of effort has follow-on effects for U.S. policy in the region. Because if U.S. forces must leave Iraq, Iraq is the logistical hub sustaining U.S. operations against ISIS in Syria. So then the U.S. has to leave Syria. That would be a massive win for Iran, because Iran has tried to get the United States out of the Middle East since the Iraq War, since 2003. So there's that dynamic at play. And then, of course, they're using their partners and proxies as part of their attempt to, you know, destroy the state of Israel. And I don't have a great grasp on exactly what lines of effort they're conducting to solve that. I think right now the regional picture is actually a lot clearer.
And as soon as Defense Secretary Austin made the announcement about this new coalition to monitor the Red Sea, more defensive action against the Houthi rebels, they came out with a statement shortly after saying that they will not stop their military operations in the Red Sea. And they talked about it as being a moral war. Mainly, it would appear they were focused on what's happening in Gaza. Is that concerning that they're just being defiant, or is that just sort of words?
Concerning for sure, not surprising though. So if you try to imagine yourself the view from the Houthis have over the last, you know, near decade now used military force basically to coerce the international community in a lot of ways to basically throw up its hands to the Houthis' military and political successes in Yemen. So for example, in 2018, there was an agreement as the UAE, the United Arab Emirates military forces were moving on Houthi positions in the critical port city of Hodeidah. We actually, the United States and the international community, introduced a Hodeidah agreement that stopped the fighting. And the UAE was really pushing hard against the Houthis and could have very well taken the city had that agreement not been put into place. And so the Houthis see these items, see these tools of appeasement that the international community has granted to the Houthis, the most recent of course, being the truce between the Houthis and Saudi Arabia. And so from their perspective, I don't think they're going to stop, because no one has ever really responded militarily to their actions before. So the lesson learned here is that from the Houthi perspective, they can do what they want with minimal consequences.
That's VOA's Lori London speaking with Brian Carter of American Enterprises Critical Threats Project. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We're reporting on borders today. We'll hear from the Poland-Ukraine border and the Russia-Finland borders coming up. Now we're off to northern Israel and its border with Lebanon. As clashes between Israel and Lebanon's militant Hezbollah group escalate along the border, VOA visited a handful of residents defending an evacuated kibbutz just 2 kilometers inside Israel. They say they want to go to war in Lebanon to eliminate Hezbollah, while the international community scrambles to find a diplomatic route. Henry Wilkins reports.
Residents say Kfar Giladi, an Israeli kibbutz 2 kilometers from the Lebanon border, was evacuated the week after the October 7 Hamas terror attack that killed 1,200 people and resulted in some 240 hostages. Since fighting has escalated in Gaza in the south, on Israel's northern border, the Iranian-backed Lebanese militant group Hezbollah has launched near-daily rocket attacks in solidarity with Hamas. At least 4 Israeli civilians and 7 soldiers have been killed in the clashes. The rockets struck Israel communities in the immediate area. A handful of residents have stayed behind to defend Kfar Giladi. Nissan Zivi is one of them.
Me, my wife and my 2 kids, my family have been evacuated. Me and my dog, and we are part of the emergency task force that stay here to protect the kibbutz. Strange feelings about how my kids can come and live here with all the security that we need. If the US and the France will not find a diplomatic solution, we will not have any choice but a military operation.
Zivi says he waits with other residents for a conflict they feel is inevitable. The Israel-Lebanon border violence has stoked fears a full-blown war could break out if Israel makes a ground attack on Hezbollah in Lebanon, or vice versa. Both Israel and Lebanon are US allies and seen as key to ensuring Mideast stability. Not only would a conflict open a second front for Israel, but it also might eventually trigger a standoff with Iran. Israeli experts say a war is not what Israel wants, but its hand may be forced. Danny Tizra is the CEO of Yozmot Limited, a company specializing in the strategic planning of civil infrastructure.
Iran is using some Hezbollah as a proxy against Israel. Our problem is not with Lebanon, our problem is with Hezbollah.
The US has urged restraint from the Israelis and is applying diplomatic pressure to find a peaceful solution on both sides of the border. Some residents say diplomatic routes to put a stop to Hezbollah attacks have already been exhausted, and the Israeli government must now find a military solution. Shadi Kalul is a resident of a nearby town.
Israel is not acting as it should act in such scenario that we faced since October 7 in Northern Front, only because US and maybe other powers ask us to calm down and not respond in aggressive way against this threat.
Locals say they fear their communities could be massacred like those in southern Israel. As dusk draws in, we begin to hear explosions nearby. Zivi says Hezbollah missiles have landed 3 kilometers away.
6 missiles have been shot to Margaliot village. No casualties, thank God, but this is part of the everyday here in the Upper Galilee next to the border.
The Israel military has stationed tanks here too, in anticipation of a possible ground invasion. Israeli attacks on the border, which it says are aimed at Hezbollah targets in Lebanon, have killed 130, including 94 Hezbollah fighters and 17 civilians. Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of deliberately targeting civilians in Lebanon, while Lebanese military facilities have also been hit, accidentally, according to Israel. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kfar Giladi, Israel.
The Scandinavian nation of Finland entered into a defense cooperation agreement with the United States on Monday. This allows the U.S. military to access Finnish national security facilities. Meanwhile, in just the past month, Finland closed its border with Russia, accusing the Kremlin of sending migrants in an act of hybrid warfare. VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gungadze visited the Finnish-Russian border and has the story.
The newest NATO member, Finland, on Friday closed its border with Russia until mid-January. Attempts were made to reopen the Valjamaa border crossing last Thursday, but authorities promptly closed it again after another influx of asylum seekers entered from Russia. Finnish officials say Russia is using the migrants as part of its hybrid warfare. Colonel Marko Saarex, Deputy Chief of Operations at Border Guard Headquarters in Helsinki.
The first time Russia has used this kind of way to affect Finnish decision-making. In the year 2015-16, there was some same kind of a phenomenon in our northern border crossing points in Lapland. They want to affect Finnish decision-making, and also this might be some kind of a statement towards Finland joining NATO, and also this agreement between Finland and the United States of America.
Finland, which shares a 1,340-kilometer border with Russia, is on high alert. The border zone, however, has no physical barriers, making patrolling difficult. The Finnish government says Russia is sending the migrants to destabilize the country, claim Russia has denied.
We have seen that the Russian authorities help and guide these migrants towards the border, give them bicycles to cross the border. During this year, they changed their policy. They freely let people to Finland, and not just let, but also actively guide them towards Finland.
The Finnish government is discussing changes to its border control legislation to enhance security and safeguard the European Union and NATO borders with Russia. Many Finns perceive Moscow's actions as a form of retaliation.
It's because we joined NATO and we have been supporting Ukraine in the war a lot. So maybe this is a punishment from Russia to Finland.
This hybrid war. And I think the background is that Finland joined the NATO last spring and then signed this DCA contract with the USA.
Finland's new defense cooperation agreement with the US comes after decades of non-military alignment and efforts to foster friendly ties with Russia. Helsinki's stance shifted after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Public support to join NATO surged as Finland sought rapid military access and aid in the event of a conflict. Miroslava Gongadze, VOA News, Finland.
And now to Poland, where truck drivers resumed their blockade of the checkpoint on the border with Ukraine. All this as President Volodymyr Zelensky held his final press conference of 2023. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has more.
The situation at the Ukraine-Poland border remains tense. At the beginning of the week, Polish truck drivers renewed the blockade of the Dorohuskia-Hodyn checkpoint, demanding to limit the entrance of Ukrainian drivers to their market. The organizers of the blockade plan to only let through one truck per hour and only cargoes of a security and humanitarian nature, as well as those transporting animals, perishable products, etc. On Tuesday, Volodymyr Zelensky held his final press conference of the year. When asked about the prospect of mobilizing an additional 400,000 to 500,000 people, Zelensky said that mobilization in this format will cost Ukraine over $13 billion. Therefore, there should be an understanding of where the money will come from and what percentage of the population should remain at their jobs supporting the economy. The president said he would not sign a bill that would suggest the mobilization of women, but might consider lowering the mobilization age for men from 27 to 25 years old. Ukrainian society is generally unhappy about the idea of mobilizing hundreds of thousands more troops. First of all, Ukrainians feel angry with Russia in the first place, which provoked the full-scale war. Secondly, about the fact that their nearest and dearest are given their lives while the corruption remains present inside Ukrainian governmental bodies, which has a direct impact on the battlefield and mobilization as a result. Last but not least, Ukraine needs people to support the economy, which will be more difficult if such a big number of the working population goes to the front line. Zelensky would not comment on the military plans for 2024 to avoid information leaks. However, he did make some sensational statements. For instance, Zelensky hinted at the possibility of restoring air traffic to and from Ukraine. Also, President Zelensky announced that Ukrainian companies will produce 1 million drones for the Ukrainian armed forces next year. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
In other border news, the European Union reached an agreement early Wednesday on new rules designed to share the cost and work of hosting migrants more evenly and to limit the numbers of people coming in. Margaritas Šinas is vice president of the EU Commission.
With the agreement, we are introducing a new and mandatory screening at all borders of all arrivals. In a second stage, all those unlikely to get asylum will have to go through mandatory, fast-tracked border procedures with streamlined procedures for dealing quickly with asylum claims.
The laws cover screening irregular migrants when they arrive in the EU, procedures for handling asylum applications, rules on determining which EU country is responsible for handling applications, and ways to handle crises. Migrant arrivals in the European Union are way down from the 2015 peak of more than 1 million people, though they have been steadily rising since 2020, with more than half crossing the Mediterranean from Africa to Italy or Malta. And that's going to end today's show. There is more coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.